Hi, it's great to be back with you guys. I don't really think you want 20 minutes of me. I think you want 20 minutes of the musos back, to be perfectly honest. But, okay. So, for those of you who don't know me, when I've spoken here before, you need to get used to a couple of things. Number one is we usually start with a quiz, which does involve chocolate, okay? And number two, when I'm speaking, usually seems a bit more perhaps like a lecture than a sermon, okay? So it's a lecton, really. I tried doing it the other way. I tried doing it as a searcher, but it sounds too much like suture. So I'm sticking with lecton. So we're going to start with a quiz. I have a very attractive assistant here. Now, she has small fragments of paper. It's multiple choice. It's not designed to embarrass you, but if you have a pen or a pencil or something, that's great. Deb has a few spare anyway, I think. So all you have to do, I'm going to read out the questions. You just have to choose whether A, B, C or D you think is the right answer. You have to be completely honest because God's watching. And then you have to figure out whether or not mathematically the challenge at the end is adding up how many you got right. Okay, and then certainly if you get 4 out of 4, you'll get a chocolate. If you get 3 out of 4, you'll probably also be onto a good thing for a chocolate, okay? So I'm just... No, sorry. No, I'm pausing for time here. Right, I think we're there, or close enough. Otherwise, if you don't have a piece of paper and you don't have a pen, you're just going to have to try to remember 4 letters. All right. Here we go. All right. Question number one. Now, this isn't... Today we're going to be looking, as you've heard, at the church outside the West. We're not specifically going to be looking a lot at missions history, although we'll touch on that a little bit. But a couple of these questions have to do with missions. Question number one. What hairstyle did missionary... Oh, we've already got some laughter, that's good. Did missionary Hudson Taylor wear that got him into trouble? What hairstyle did missionary Hudson Taylor wear that got him into trouble? Was it A, a ponytail? B, a pigtail? C, a mohawk? Or D, an afro? So those options... No correspondence can be entered into... Oh, no. No, you can't. No. No clarifying questions. Okay, so was it A, a ponytail, B, a pigtail, C, a mohawk, or D, an afro? All right, so you just have to do that. Question two. How many miles, and I'm sorry for those of you who only work in kilometres, you just have to do the conversion rate at about 2.2. How many miles did David Livingstone cover on foot in 4 years in his efforts to explore Africa for missionary endeavours? So it's how many miles did he cover on foot in 4 years? Was it A, 8,000 miles, B, 11,000 miles, C, 13,000 miles, or D, 15,000 miles? So in order, 8,000, 11,000, 13,000, or 15,000. Question three. A 1910 missions conference in Edinburgh believed the world... You ever heard the phrase, you know, winning the world in our generation? I think this is where it started. This conference was very optimistic that in 1910 the world could be won for Christ, the gospel could reach every part of the world within one generation. And they had a bunch of reasons why. You have to tell me which of the following was not one of their reasons why. So three of them were. Which one is the odd one out? Which one wasn't one of their reasons? A, all the main languages of the world, I don't know how they classified main languages, so don't go there, but all the main languages of the world had at least the New Testament. B, indigenous leaders were arising. C, Mormons couldn't make progress in China because Mormon meant gates of hell in Mandarin. Or D, difficult countries like China and Japan were beginning to open to the gospel. So which one wasn't one of their reasons for optimism? A, all the main languages of the world had at least a New Testament. B, indigenous leaders were arising. C, Mormons couldn't make progress in China because Mormon meant gates of hell in Mandarin. Or D, difficult countries like China and Japan were beginning to open to the gospel. And the final question, which could determine whether or not you get a chocolate. Which of the following areas today has the highest percentage of Christians in its population? Which of the following areas, well, they're really actually all countries, has the highest percentage of Christians? A, the Philippines. B, England. C, South Korea. Or D, the United States. Which country has the highest percentage of Christians? Philippines, England, South Korea, or United States? So, you should have numbers 1 to 4 and a letter next to each of them. Okay? If you haven't managed that, you probably aren't going to get a chocolate. Okay? All right, so this is where the honesty system comes in. Here are the answers. Hudson Taylor got into trouble for wearing a pigtail. He was a missionary to China in the 19th century and adopted local dress and customs, and that was not the done thing. David Livingstone, so the right answer there, if you want, was B for number one. Hi. A ponytail isn't plaited, sort of. I got a hair question right. Okay. The David Livingstone question two, is anyone wearing a ponytail? Anyone want to demonstrate? No? Okay. Only after the answer, you see. If you're pigtail is plaited. Okay, look. If there are any hairdressers in the audience, you know, do a private tutorial later. Okay. Question two, moving on from matters hirsute, okay. Question two, the correct answer is B. It was 11,000 miles. I know I would have sucked a few of you in there with the large numbers. That was my plan. Okay. So, all right, so we've got the two right answers so far are both Bs. Question three, the correct answer here is C. It was the one about Mormons. Now, this was a bit of a trick question, actually. Because, funnily enough, Mormon does sound exactly like Gates of Hell in Mandarin. And it is a reason why Mormonism makes very slow progress in China. Welcome to the Gates of Hell Church. You know, doesn't work that well. But that wasn't a reason back then, in 1910. Okay, so. And finally, what do you think for four? Which country, highest percentage?
South Korea.
Yeah, I thought that would suck a few of you in. South Korea, the last figures I saw were it's around about 50-ish percent. But the Philippines is around about 80%. Okay? So Philippines is A. Okay. So, hands up. Did anyone get four? Would be very amazing if you did get four. Point of clarification, did anyone get four right? Anyone get three? Oh, these people definitely get a chocolate. Okay. How about two? Okay, we better go for all the twos here and give them all a chocolate as well. Okay. See, I have a very high opinion of this congregation. I think the bag I got has 28 chocolates, you see. So I think very highly of you. Okay, so while they're being distributed, we'll kick off. So our topic is Christianity's many tongues, the church beyond the West. So I've presented a bit on church history here in the past. I've been challenged to look outside the West. And so we're going to do that today. And if you ask a lot of people about the general sweep of church history after the book of Acts. Most of us, and guilty as charged, will tend to focus on the Middle East, Europe, and then the Atlantic world after that. We know, most people know, look, there are periods of persecution. The Roman Empire adopts Christianity early in the 4th century, and then about 150 years after that, the Roman Empire itself falls, fairly general knowledge. And then enter the barbarians, the Dark Ages, a general decline in literacy and concern for things like administration and table manners. Okay. In the midst of all this, again, most people are well aware, Islam arises, and of course everybody knows at least something about the Crusades. Now, countries that had previously had a strong Christian presence, again, there's a general awareness those countries became, in many cases, Islamic. And so when we get somewhere in the Middle Ages, for a lot of people, the general impression is that really outside of Europe, everything pretty much either gets dominated by Islam or it reverts to tribalism. I mean, Islam, for goodness sake, it takes over North Africa, it takes over Spain. I mean, it nearly gets into France, you know. If it hadn't been for the Battle of Tours, goodness knows what would have happened to the wine industry. It would have been a bit of a disaster. And then for some of us, there's a bit of a gap in there, and then later on we pick up, sort of in the modern church history period, there's an awareness that a lot of the Roman Catholic countries are sending out, you know, monks and Jesuits to different parts of the world. And then the Protestants jump onto the missions bandwagon a little bit later on. So that's, I guess, a general impression that's out there. And that particular, I guess, interpretation really does overlook a great deal of what was established in both Africa and Asia. That in many cases kept going with a contrary story to that particular storyline. So we're going to look a little bit at that, obviously at a pretty superficial level in many ways, for the next few minutes. Starting with Asia. Now, as Christianity spreads, again, many of us would be aware there's about five centres that surface pretty quickly. And of those five centres, really only one of them is in Europe, and that's Rome. Okay. The others, you've got three in Asia. You've got Constantinople, Antioch, and Jerusalem. Okay. And then you've got Alexandria in Egypt, which is Africa. Okay. So we've immediately got, when you look at those centres, as Christianity spreads after the New Testament era, it's already got a focus that's outside of Europe. And of those centres, really, for a long time, Constantinople was more dominant than Rome. Constantine has his second capital there, lives there, and really it becomes more important in many ways than Rome was. Quite a few popes in the 7th and 8th century, for example, are Syrian. And you can actually trace this Syrian influence in some of the feasts, some of the worship features of the current Roman Catholic Church are still there centuries later. If you look at the 10th century, for example, there's still hundreds of bishops in the area that was called Asia Minor, which we now largely think of as Turkey. And interestingly, these Christians tended to, in a sense, look down their nose at Rome. For them, Constantinople was really the centre of the world. Latin was a second-rate language. And the real languages that you thought about, significant things like theology, and were languages like Greek and Syrian. And they worked in that. Theologically, a lot of these churches sometimes have the label Nestorian. I don't want to get too much into that, but at one of the early church councils, Council of Ephesus in 431, when they're thrashing out what the church believes and looking at what we believe particularly about Christ, Nestorius had a position which really was in the end, ruled against that Christ really had two separate persons in him. And they saw that as essentially denying the reality of the incarnation. Now, there's a big debate about whether or not his position was clearly understood, so we're not going to go there. But a lot of the churches in the East followed that particular line, and so they're considered to be Nestorian. One of the fascinating guys in this period after, or as we enter what we think of as the Dark Ages, I guess, early part of the Middle Ages, and clearly, as we're about to see, can't really be called the Dark Ages where we're going. Okay, there's a chap around about 780 called Timothy, becomes known as Timothy the First, and he was a bishop. He becomes patriarch of the Eastern Church. He's based at a place called Seleucia in Mesopotamia, which is modern-day Iraq. He lives a long time for that period. He lived, I think, into his 90s. And it's really fascinating to see just what the church was doing in that particular era and in those areas. And in fact, as we're going to look at his ministry for a couple of minutes, but long after he dies, the church in Iraq flourishes well after the rise of Islam. Okay, so it's a bit of a faulty thinking to think that everywhere Islam becomes strong, immediately the church is in eclipse. That's not the case at all. So in Timothy's era, around about 800, the Eastern churches actually were at a level of learning that the Western churches would not catch up to until the 13th century, so 400 or 500 years later. And they had a much higher level of learning generally in the Arabic cultures. One of the things apparently that is interesting is that it's often, when you trace it back, it's often a lot of these early Christian scholars that were contributing to the flourishing of culture in the Arabic world. And you know, a lot of people look at it and say, oh yeah, the West goes through the Dark Ages and the East really doesn't, and you've got, you know, Arabic culture flourishing. Intriguingly, a lot of that was due to Christian Syriac scholars who were there. But back to Timothy. So he's bishop for about 43, patriarch for about 43 years. Now, during that time, he establishes new metropolitan sees, in other words, major seats in cities. One is near Tehran, one's in Syria, one's in Turkestan, one's in Armenia, one's on the Caspian Sea. During his time, Arabia had at least four seas, and they started a new one in Yemen. Okay, they're also planning one in Tibet. Right, this is a bit of a different picture, isn't it? Okay, you know, you go to Tibet. Well, that's going right over. Hang on, right over that way. Okay, on the map. He has correspondence with churches in India, which historically go back to the very early second century and link back to Thomas. He commissions monks to take the gospel into China. Now, this is around the year 800, but the gospel had already been in China for about 200 years before that, around 600 or so AD. And the Chinese church continues on quite strongly through the Mongol dynasty in the 13th and 14th centuries under rulers that we might have heard of, people like Kublai Khan. And when Marco Polo arrives, and we've all probably stumbled across him at some point, much later, he actually sends home reports on the Chinese Christian communities that he finds that are already there. Okay. It's not until really the 13th century that Roman Catholic missionaries arrive in China to discover that really something's been going on there for about 600 years. And as we said, you know, India, from the very early second century, the legacy of St. Thomas was there. So before there's an archbishop in Canterbury, okay, there are churches in Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Sri Lanka, Malabar on the coast of India, So when we think about the church of the early Middle Ages, there's actually a very comprehensive Asian element that we usually overlook. Now, by the time Timothy dies in 823, actually Christianity in the West is looking pretty fragile. And there's a number of reasons for that. Obviously, Islam is on the scene by then. But in the following century or so, after Timothy dies, in other words, the rest of the 800s into the 900s, almost all the British and Irish monasteries have been destroyed by largely Vikings, I guess, who rummage through the country, destroy a lot of stuff, then marry nice English girls and become farmers, and probably you send off your ancestry DNA kit and probably find half if you're related to them. Spain is Muslim. As we fleetingly mentioned earlier, southern France looks like it's going to perhaps fall to Islam. So at the time, the West is actually looking pretty shaky in terms of how stable Christianity is. The East is looking pretty good. Okay. Africa. A bit of a different story here. We mentioned that there was a strong centre in Alexandria in Egypt. And Christianity spreads down the Nile. It becomes particularly strong in Ethiopia. After the rise of Islam, though, the North African part of Christianity along the coast of the Mediterranean, which had been particularly strong, places like Tunisia and Algeria, really falls quickly, and you don't hear much more of that North African church after that. But this is quite sad because North Africa had contributed a huge amount in the early years of the church. Some of the great church fathers, guys like Cyprian and Tertullian and Augustine, were all North Africans. But Coptic Christianity in Egypt really remains quite vigorous. If you landed in the 6th century in North Africa, in other words, before the rise of Islam, you'd find that there are basically about 500 Christian bishops in the area we think of as Tunisia and Algeria. But if you landed in the 8th century, you wouldn't find any. So there was quite a different picture there from what we've just referred to in Asia. So there were periods of persecution, periods of toleration as Islam and Christianity met each other. Finally, in the 10th century, there's a very strong persecution by one of the caliphs, which was an unprecedented one. Apparently, he was completely insane. But that meant that centres that had been strong in Africa of Christianity, like Nubia and Abyssinia, did become strongly Islamic. And even Ethiopian Christianity was very much weakened by the 13th and 14th centuries. So in many ways, scholars have noticed really that it's probably fair to say that African Christianity was less vigorous than Asian Christianity. And they've posed a couple of reasons for that. One is that a lot of the key leaders in the African church tended to focus more on cities rather than the spread throughout the entire population of the faith. And the other one really, I guess, is language. One of the powerhouses of Asian Christianity was the Greek Syriac language, whereas in Africa there was a much greater language diversity, so communication was an issue. A couple of statistics for you. Some of you I know will like statistics. So if, as we move through the Middle Ages, between, say, 1200 and 1500, that 300 or so year period, the number of Asian Christians falls, they've estimated, from 21 million to 3.4 million. During the same period, the percentage of the world's Christians living in Africa and Asia combined fell from 34% to 6%. Okay. So that's why, in a sense, when we look at the story of Christianity from, let's say, the perspective of modern missions, and that links, the whole era of naval exploration, the countries that had navies, really kicks off late 1400s into the 1500s. Everyone's running around the world, sticking their flags on bits of land and claiming it for some European nation or other and bringing either Protestantism or Roman Catholicism with them. That's why when we look from that point of view backwards, it seems like Christianity was either non-existent or highly negligible before the arrival of those people in the 1600s. So Christianity had become European, as those stats reflect, but it had become European because of decline in places like Africa and Asia, where it had previously been strong. And it became European about 1,000 years later than most people think. Now, as the Middle Ages progress, Protestantism arrives on the scene. Roman Catholics get off to a much earlier start than Protestants on the mission field. They've got a single workforce they can deploy at a moment's notice. A lot of the Roman Catholic nations like France and Spain and Italy were naval nations. They had navies they could easily deploy. And, of course, the Protestants decided to, you know, have a few religious differences for about 150 years and fight amongst themselves before they could get off the ground with anything to do with missions. So when both groups did start, often it was from a point of view of ignorance about what had happened before, and often from the perception there'd been nothing there before in terms of Christianity. And as we all know, often with the introduction of the gospel, as they perceived it, they were also trying to inject European culture. Now, that's not only condescending, but in the light of what we've just glanced at, it's also really deeply ironic. Here we are to bring you the gospel. Sadly, a lot of the people they were introducing this new thing to themselves had lost the historical awareness. We actually had this about 600 years ago, guys. We were there before you. At least, though, from the time of someone like William Carey, around about 1800, things start to change. He introduces the idea, hey, maybe it's not just the Europeans who should be preaching. Maybe we should actually raise up indigenous leaders, which was revolutionary at the time. Roman Catholic missionaries, although they got off to an earlier start than the Protestants, had the handicap, again, in the communication area, that everything for them had to be in Latin. Really, where the Protestants were, of course, from the word go, trying to put everything into the vernacular languages. Then we hit interesting waters, particularly for some of the Jesuits when they went to countries in Asia, often got involved in politics. And sadly, that led to countries that were either opening to the gospel for the first time, that hadn't had much of a Christian presence before, let's say perhaps like Japan, or countries that had, like China, had a strong Christian presence in centuries before, suddenly closing their door to Christianity because of political interference. And then again, you have a further irony. When I was doing my postgraduate work, one of the things my supervisor, and we still joke about this together, he had to get the word ironic out of probably about every fourth sentence in my doctorate. Because everything I looked at was ironic. We still argue about it. I think most history is ironic. I think irony is God's sense of humour, to be honest. But it's ironic that when China, for example, starts banning Christianity in the 1720s, it's looking at it very much as a Western import, a Johnny-come-lately. Whereas, in fact, of course, as we now know, it had been there a very long time before. You get a lot of massacres. Japan, classically, 1638. Again, it's seen, Christianity is seen as a Western import, probably a bit more true in the case of Japan, but it led to tens of thousands of Christians being killed because of political interference in the 1630s. So for all these mishaps and misadventures of the missionary endeavour, which we've just touched on a couple, the 19th century really is, in a sense, the golden age of missions. That's why that missions conference in 1910 was so optimistic, because all the Western nations are galloping around Africa and Asia and sticking their flags on everything and bringing the gospel with it. And so there's optimism there, but running counter to that, there's also a deep vein of uncertainty in the 19th century. You know, if you throw a number of things in the mix, Darwin, Freud, Marx, Nietzsche, Throw that into the mix of the West, and they're already having a bit of a spin. But then also, as they encounter these cultures, they'd always known about Buddhism, they'd always known about Islam, of course, but they're encountering a bewildering variety of new cultures and beliefs as they do go around the world in the 19th century. So at the time that, in one sense, missions looks like it's flourishing, at another sense, Christianity in the West are having a deep crisis of conscience. So this brings us to relatively recent history and the sort of thing that we probably have a general awareness of. If you start Googling, you know, Christian presence in the world today, one of the fascinating things to do is when you look at the map of Africa, you know how Africa sort of looks like a gun holster? You do a line across the bulge and everything south of that is hugely Christian today. Interestingly, with the exception of, say, you know, maybe Ethiopia, it was North Africa that was had the strongest Christian presence originally. Now, South Africa, Southern Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa is profoundly Christian, as are many countries in Asia and Latin America. A couple more stats for you. Are we going to lose any children out there? Do we need to bring them in? okay. In 1900, if anyone's phoning in to critique my sermon, that's okay. I'll take that. In 1900, there were approximately 10 million Christians in Africa. By 2000, there were approximately 360 million. They're estimating, one estimate, and I think this estimate is about 3 years old, but they were estimating in 2015... that by 2025, conservatively, in Africa, there'd be 633 million Christians. That's the same estimates put the number of Christians in Latin America in 2025 at 640 million, in Asia at 460 million. And according to this writer, who's a guy called Jenkins, and the book's called The Next Christendom, if you want to check it up, but he's saying the percentage of the world's population that is at least nominally Christian will be roughly the same in 2050 as it was in 1900. By the middle of this century, there'll be, according to this, 3 billion Christians in the world, which he thought was going to be significantly more than the number of Muslims. And in fact, by 2050, he thought there's probably going to be nearly as many Pentecostal Christians as Muslims. The interesting thing, though, is when you look at how that's changing. And, you know, many of you would be aware the geographic centre of Christianity obviously is changing rapidly. He said, by 2050, only one-fifth, 20% of the world's Christians will be non-Hispanic whites. So the typical Christian at that time would be a woman living in a village in Nigeria or in a Brazilian shantytown. So the demographics of Christianity are changing dramatically. So, in closing, God's sense of humour, as I said, I think, is deeply ironic. You know, he can wait for centuries for the punchline. That's one of the benefits of being eternal. We tend to want people to laugh at our jokes a little bit quicker than that. So the day of Pentecost is profoundly polyglot, many tongues, okay? And they're all there from the birth of the church. There's a harmony amongst those many tongues, those many voices, though that's short-lived. And the church, in many ways, does have a cultural and a linguistic battle that breaks out. And different sides tend to marginalise the other on those cultural and linguistic points. The irony is, though, that it's a bit like, you know, members of an estranged family. Some of you might sadly be in estranged families or have observed estranged families where you stop talking to certain members of the family for some period of time. You're actually very aware of their existence, but you just don't talk to them. And as the years go by, you sort of don't think about them very much. And then the next generation has pretty much forgotten them. Okay. Well, it's a bit like that with the story of the church outside the West. And the irony is that although perhaps not many of those memories really have been recovered, the areas that have been marginalised by the West are now actually, you can fill in the sentence for yourself, the areas where the church is growing most rapidly and most vibrantly. Areas like sub-Saharan Africa, South Korea, Oceania, which like the Philippines apparently has those far-flung islands that people would have thought were the ends of the earth, apparently now 80-90% Christian. So the places that were ignored, the places that were thought of as being unchristian, never having had the gospel, are now actually flourishing centres of the gospel. They're the ones who are preaching, who are reaching out, who are sending ministries to the West. I think God's laughing, to be honest. So this brings us back to our scripture of Matthew 28. The Great Commission. The gospel was, from its birth, polyglot, many tongues, many languages. You know, it can speak in and through all languages and cultures, and it also confronts all languages and cultures. It's never been monocultural, although certainly the perception has been dominant for some periods and in certain areas that it has been. The old centres of the church, centres in Africa, centres in Asia, are speaking to us anew. And I think we're called strongly to have the humility to listen to those voices. Publications are coming out, Asian theology, African theology. Those voices are being recognised, being published and being heard. And I think it captures something of the wonder of the huge canvas God is working on, the many stories that he's weaving together that we're part of. And obviously the church should be ashamed of ignoring a lot of those stories for a long period of time. We ignore them to our own detriment. We ignore them to our poverty. And I pray that we have the strength and the humility to embrace them and to catch something of the sense of wonder of what God's doing. Let's pray. Father, we can only imagine the canvas that you're working on. We can only glimpse parts of it. We can only see a little bit. But what we do see captures us, captures our hearts with awe and with wonder at your love, at your perseverance, and yes, often at your sense of humour and irony, particularly that you choose to work through and in people like us. That is the wonder of your grace. The fact that we have a place in this tapestry that you're weaving is an amazing thing. May we be humble to see the ways in which you're working. May we be open to participate in this multicultural, multilingual effort that is your church. May we hear the voices of those that have not been heard perhaps for many centuries and participate with them in bringing you all the glory and all the praise in your church. In Jesus' name, amen.